Что и так начинается прямая линия.
Ребята, привет, это Навальный.
Итак, в прямом эфире президент Российской Федерации.
Коррупционеры запрещают нам проводить антикоррупционные митинги.
Спасибо вам, спасибо ведущим, спасибо.
Мы выходим на улицу, потому что мы люди.
Все будет хорошо, так оно и будет, подтверждаю.
The choreographed televised spectacle versus the defiance of the street. The master of the universe versus the maverick revolutionary. Vladimir Putin versus Alexei Navalny. Welcome to the battle for Russia's future. In many ways, the optics of this past week are a microcosm of what appears to be a long, slow struggle ahead. It'll be a test of wills, a contest of images, and a competition of narratives. Putin is saying he's making Russia great again, and Navalny is saying we can do much better than this. So what did we learn this past week? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, an editor at Open Democracy Russia. Welcome back, Natalia. Great to have you back on again so soon.
Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Good to be back.
Good to have you. So the week began with tens of thousands taking to the streets in more than 180 Russian cities, if I'm not mistaken. And it ended with that annual Rite of Spring, Putin's call-in program, which to me looked a bit lackluster this year. Mark, what was your take in the past week on the competition of images?
Let's start with Direct Line, because definitely, you know, if this was a TV show, this would be like sort of Series 7, by which all the stars from Series 1 have already been replaced and they're desperately recycling storylines. I felt a pretty dire spectacle, and frankly, from the look of it, I think Putin felt the same way. Mm-hmm. The problem is he's stuck with it. He can't cancel it. Otherwise, we would precisely be sitting here thinking, well, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and reading into it. So basically, he is saddled with it. With the sort of exception of the kind of surreal sort of near birth on television moment and the sort of fascinating off message text messages that kept sort of bubbling up.
How did they let that happen?
I think it was on purpose.
You think it was on purpose?
I think it was on purpose. I think they felt they really had to balance the positive coverage this year. And I'm like 99% sure that it was on purpose.
For those who don't know what we're talking about along the crawler, text messages, questions and text messages were shown on screen. And they were saying things like, aren't you tired of doing this every year? Aren't you ready to resign? And so on.
Interesting enough, those were not the questions that actually he ended up replying to. In the main, but yeah, I mean, you know, whether that was an attempt to sort of add some excitement into the process, or a total and colossal mess up, or whatever, who knows? But nonetheless, even that did not in any way salvage this
right.
4-hour sort of endurance feat. But as regards to the sort of the Navalny protest, although I must admit, I can't help but feel that Navalny probably made a tactical mistake by moving the Moscow protest into Tverskaya, where it sort of, you know, clashed with the medieval and modern reenactments. But in general terms, we saw larger turnout in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. We saw protests in towns that up to now hadn't had mm-hmm. protests. And in any case, I mean, like any guerrilla, Navalny wins by not being defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, I think you may have made a sort of a tactical error in Moscow, but I'm sure he'll learn the lesson.
Not everybody thinks so.
Yeah.
Not everybody thinks so.
But I'm busy pontificating my own perspective. But, you know, but anyway, but almost regardless of that, the point is, in general terms, the fact that, you know, despite the pressure, mm-hmm. You know, this is still rolling. He maintained his momentum. He may not have expanded it by that much, but the point is, nor did it shrink. So, you know, that definitely counts as a win on points to Navalny.
Mm-hmm. I would also, I would argue, if I may pontificate, that by moving it, and I had mixed feelings about this when he did it, but I started to think about it and think, why is Navalny doing this? What is he doing? And what he's doing is saying, I don't have to obey your rules. I'm going to have it wherever the hell I want to have it. And I'm going to have it on Tverskaya. And you're going to, I know you're going to stop me, but I'm not going to obey. We're not respecting your rules. We don't ask your permission to come to the streets. And that's how I saw it.
But see, I think that's a dangerous move for him. And actually, the point is, look, protests like this, they have to do two things, or at least they have to kind of find the sweet spot that balances two things. One is pleasing and mobilizing your existing constituency. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is actually then obviously passing it on and attracting more people mm-hmm. to your cause. Now, I can see how this kind of plays to Navalny's existing base. Yes, absolutely. We're not going to be told. Because it's not as if they were given a bad location before mm-hmm. on Sakharov. But nonetheless, if we're talking about actually extending it beyond, I mean, it manages to actually play to one of the few cards Putin has got to play, which is Navalny is dangerous. Even if Navalny is a sort of a well-meant spirit himself, this is destabilizing and dangerous and so forth. And therefore, I'm not convinced at this stage. Again, it's like guerrilla warfare. There is that point where you move from being scattered little bands of essentially terrorists to the point where you actually have to field a military force if you want to win. In good sort of, you know, Vietnam style.
Right.
We're nowhere near the end of phase one yet. He's not in a position where he can actually sort of directly challenge the state and basically say, we will break the law if we want to. Because that's the point when the state says, well, actually, the law will break you if need be.
Natalia, what was your take on this week? You have the virtue of being on the ground there in Moscow. We had these two spectacles.
Well, I'm actually really fascinated by the argument put forth by some of Navalny's liberal critics after he had moved the protest and a lot of people were detained. There is this criticism out there now. And we actually, at Open Democracy Russia, we just published a translation of an article that originally appeared on Coulter-Roo, which argues that how transparent is the decision-making in the Navalny camp? Is he the only one making these decisions? And is it, is the movement that he's in charge of looking a little bit too top-down right now? I don't think anybody has gone as far as call him, like, say, a mini Putin, for example. but I do think that some people are seeing this as a decision that was made, just by one person. And it was made without, regard, as Mark was saying, it was made without regard for safety. And I think that for a lot of these liberal critics of Navalny, of course, they ultimately support the decision because, like it or hate it, it made this protest more visible. But I think they would want to see more, possibly more community style organizing in the future with regard to what he's doing and obviously with regard to a lot of these, what these other protests are doing, because there's other protest movements, of course, that are happening in Russia right now, which are not necessarily as visible as Navalny. You know, we kind of seize on him in the Western media, of course, immediately. But there's other less glamorous people. Well, glamorous is the wrong word. I don't think Navalny's a glamorous guy. I think he's a pretty straightforward guy, actually. But, there's the truckers, there's the farmers, and those decisions about how they behave themselves, those decisions are at least, they appear to be generally more community generated. Whereas with the Navalny movement, there is this criticism that maybe it's gotten a little bit too top down. And it's, we don't need like a mini power vertical here. What we need is more open discussion.
And the fears are that could be a kind of foreshadowing how he would govern should he ever seize the.
That fear has actually been around for a long time. That fear, I think, has been around since the 2011-2012 protests in Russia. That he is a very charismatic personality. That his movement is very personality driven, and people back then were saying, "Well, this is a little bit too similar to what Putin's doing." But of course, he's also. We have to keep in mind that he's also an anti-corruption guy, and he's very much about sticking to the law in a big way. And obviously, that's where he differs wildly from, the current government and how it conducts itself. So I just think that whole discussion around Navalny right now is really fascinating. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think it's a good discussion to keep in mind as we cover these protests.
But I think the very fact that that discussion is going on is indicative that Navalny is somebody to be taken very, very, very seriously, and that this is somebody who could very well be ruling Russia at some point in the future. That's why all this discussion is, why people are unnerved by this stuff a little.
Well, the Kremlin seems to be taking him seriously, doesn't it?
Yes.
And in fact, if you look at the call-in show, his name was never uttered. He's like Voldemort. He must not be named. And that means that he is indeed perceived on one level or another as a serious, potentially dangerous adversary.
Natalia, how do you see the kind of the battle of the optics this week? We had with the Putin call-in show spectacle and the Navalny show on Monday on the streets. How did you see that playing out?
Well, I have to agree with Mark. I think that the call-in show was just really especially terrible and depressing this year. I can't imagine, I don't know how Putin can handle just sitting there for 4 hours playing Santa Claus to all these impoverished people who are calling in and saying, we don't have a road, or I was misdiagnosed and I now have stage 4 cancer, or here's the building we've been living in and there's literally holes in the walls of this building. And that is just, you know, like, I think this is why they actually are probably on purpose, maybe on purpose, showing these text messages from really angry people, just really mocking Putin and being extremely condescending towards him. Because this constant show of like poor people having to appeal to Putin because they can't appeal to their local officials because their local officials are at best inefficient, at worst fantastically corrupt. There is this sense that, okay, well, but who's really presiding over this system that doesn't seem to work very well? Well, it's Putin, right. You know, so in reality, the buck stops with him. And of course, I feel like maybe in previous years, there still was the sense that, okay, yeah, your local officials are not doing their jobs, but hey, guys, you still get a chance to kind of appeal to the good czar who has no idea how bad his boyars are screwing up. And the good czar will fix this problem for you. But now I think we're really starting to get this sense that these problems are not going away. The good czar is presiding over a system that just, you know, just isn't working as it's not working as it should. And I have to question, how sustainable is this format going forward, you know, both for Russian state television and I think for the Kremlin in general?
What did you make of the optics of the protests, Munda? Judging from what you're saying, it sounds like you also think Navalny won the battle of the optics this week.
I think, yeah, I think that maybe definitely in Moscow he did. I think that people outside of Moscow may not have even been that aware of what was going on. I don't think there was that much coverage of what happened. But obviously in Moscow, where all the big decisions are made, clearly in the federal center, he did win. I think that I agree with a lot of the people who are saying that it's all about young people. It's all about his young followers. And I think we're going to get to that theme.
Yeah.
Later on in the program, but I do think that it's not so much Navalny as a figure necessarily. Obviously, he has sacrificed a lot. You know, he just went to jail again for like 30 days. His brother, I would remind our listeners, is imprisoned on some really sketchy charges. And very obvious case of his family member being taken hostage by the state. So I feel like people are very sympathetic to what he's doing, and they see him fighting this battle, this David up against Goliath, and I do think they're sympathetic in many ways. But I think that ultimately it came down to his followers being really fearless or really foolish, depending on how you see it, and just, you know, not caring that this protest was unsanctioned once again.
No, Oleg Kashin, in a very interesting piece in Republik.ru this week, wrote that Navalny has turned himself into the second most important politician in the country. It's Putin. This is what gave me the idea to frame this way, a truth in advertising. But it's basically Navalny and Putin, and nobody else really matters at all right
well,
now.
Well, Putin is the one who made sure that nobody else matters, right? Because his entire system is built around one man. And any popular politician, any politician that gets too popular, too visible, is, you know, seen as a threat to the great leader, to the so-called benevolent czar. So, of course, it kind of makes sense that the second most important politician is not going to be part of the Putin camp, but is going to arise out of a protest slash dissident camp.
Mark, I see your writing, so I'm going to give you a chance to put that writing into words.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm slightly sort of cautious about the cash-in line. I mean, snappy though it is, because in a way, Navalny may be the second most important politician, but we shouldn't think that politicians are necessarily where power lies in this system. Mm. There are many more powerful people. But I think we ought to remember something. This is not a struggle of Navalny versus Putin. Navalny is not going to beat Putin. There was any question about Navalny potentially beating Putin.
Not in March 2018, he's not.
No, but... I mean, I don't think he is at all. And I don't think Navalny expects to. This is Navalny against the Putin system.
So he's positioning himself to be in place when this
exactly.
thing exhausts itself.
You know, it's not as though Putin is either going to stand in a free and fair election in which he might lose, or even that he will sort of find himself being sort of swept aside by a tide of protesters. That nice Mr. Zolotov will ensure mm-hmm. that's okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is, we have to think of it in these slightly systemic terms about kind of building a long thing. And here, I think this is where the significance of, what we might actually think of as purely optics, the fact that at his direct line, sort of Putin demonstrated all the sort of pizzazz of a corporate accountant stuck in a health and safety meeting after a particularly large lunch. Because actually, in some ways, that is what Putin has become. And he's positioned himself precisely as the corporate accountant.
And Navalny is the badass on the street.
If one looks at actually his message so often in the direct line was basically, trust us, the economy, this time the economy has turned the corner. Which is, after all, something that he kept belaboring, that it was all just over the horizon last time. Now, the point is, the reason he has to belabor that is because even if the official macroeconomic statistics are saying that, ordinary Russians are not feeling it, mm-hmm. and they will not be feeling it for a while. Because, even if the economy really does improve, and even if a reasonable share of that actually gets spent on public services rather than new bridges to Sakhalin or whatever, all the other sort of things that the government prefers to spend itself on. It takes a long time for public services to be built up. So basically, he was in the position of being the Medvedev saying, there's no money, but hang in there.
Right.
And I think this is why this really matters in terms of, it's not just about who looks more impressive, who looks more badass or whatever. It is also about, in a way, Navalny having to position himself as two things. One is a credible individual, the sort of person who could be a leader. And and this is going back to exactly what was being said before, that, this is one of the reasons why he's having to sort of, and probably also by character, being something of a one-man leader of the movement, which a lot of people don't like, and in part that's frankly jealousy and so forth. So he has to position himself as a leader, but he also has to have something credible to say. And that, for me, is the really dangerous thing for Putin. It's actually, bit by bit, Navalny is bringing together a plausible platform. So it's not just Navalny versus Putin. It's what does Putin stand for and what does Navalny stand for?
Yeah, and I got into this in the blog earlier this week, and I touched on it today in this morning's Daily Vertical, and you basically segued, thank you, Mark, right into exactly where I wanted to go.
I aim to please.
That's perfect. That's because my other takeaway from this week, and I talked about this in this morning on the Morning Vertical, is Putin has basically run out of stories to tell people. Putin is a master storyteller. He's told stories from the minute he appeared on the scene as the president in waiting. Right? He told a story about how he's going to wipe out the terrorists in the outhouse. He was going to restore order to Russia, create a dictatorship of law, battle the oligarchs. It was a compelling story. He was going to rescue Russia from the chaos of the 90s. Never mind that he benefited handsomely from the chaos of the 90s. And never mind that he replaced the oligarchs he vanquished with his own set of oligarchs. The people bought it. They bought that story. They really did buy that story. And when that story ran out of steam, he came up with another story. He annexed Crimea, invaded Donbass, and said, I am going to return Russia to the ranks of great powers. You are up off your knees. And people bought it. They loved that story. Now he doesn't have a story anymore. And this is the first time, as I was watching this, I was like, Putin doesn't have a story to tell. I was waiting to see what story is going to emerge here. Meanwhile, Navalny is telling a story. He's saying, yes, we can. You're telling us we can't be Europeans. You're telling us we can't have a democratic government. You're telling us we have to. We can't overcome corruption. Yes, we can. That's an optimistic story. Now, optimistic stories play real well on the stage. They don't, Russia's got a little bit different of a perspective on these things. But what do you make of the clash of these, well, Putin's non-story right now and Navalny's story?
Well, Natalia, you're the playwright.
Yeah,
what do you
there
think?
You go. Yeah, we have an expert on stories.
As a playwright, I am very worried about Putin's current lack of story. Because I think that basically when the Kremlin runs out of stories, it tends to do something drastic. And I'm just sitting around right now waiting for the drastic thing to happen, you know, for the plan to reveal itself, for the plot twist, as it may. And that worries me greatly. Also, I think that as far as Navalny goes, I agree with this yes, we can assessment. It's very much in that same vein, in the same spirit. It is also potentially dangerous down the line because how is it going to keep playing out? We don't know. We saw what happened with the yes, we can spirit eventually in the States. I'm not going to get into Trump right now, but on some level, Trump is an extension of a lot of people deciding that that story doesn't work. But I think that the big concern right now is what is the next drastic thing the Kremlin is going to do in order to have a story again? And I'm guessing it's going to be foreign policy related.
Well, this is if you look back to the last time the Kremlin didn't have a story, back to when this podcast began, back in 2011, 2012, it looked like the Kremlin didn't have a story. And the next thing you know, they came up with their new story. They like I said, they annexed Crimea, invaded Donbass, and here we are. What can they do to top that? See, I don't see anything foreign policy wise they can do to top that, short of like marching on Kyiv, which is
not really
viable. I don't think.
I don't know. Is it? We have Trump in power right now in the States, and of course, I tend to be paranoid about Kyiv related matters because I was born there, and it's I still have a lot of relatives there, and I'm there a lot, and it's kind of like still like one of my homes is definitely my hometown. So I'm always going, oh God, he's going to march on Kyiv. So is that my paranoia talking, or are those my spider senses just predicting the future? I really hope I'm wrong on this, but I think there's always that potential. There's always that possibility.
Mark, what do you think they're going to try to come up with a new story? And if so, what kind of story are they going to come? Because this Kremlin's never not had a story, and it doesn't have one now. It's just painfully obvious.
Have one now, and I mean, it has to be said, Natalia, I think it's your paranoia. I don't think they have the capacity to do that kind of thing. But what's interesting is actually it's not just that it doesn't seem to demonstrate a story. It's actually that we see a lot of activity that precisely suggests that not only are there a lot of people within the government system painfully aware that there isn't a story, but they're all kind of scrabbling around trying to find one. There was an interesting recent piece suggesting that there was this sort of struggle between Volodin trying to sort of make the Duma more significant at the expense of Kiryenko and the presidential administration. We have the struggles over different models for economic development, you know, from Kudrin through to more conservative models and such like. And the interesting thing is that in part one could say, well, this is one actor in search of a story. You know, this is a whole sort of series of different people, in a way, trying to present different forms of narrative. But they're not. In a way, these are very micro-scale things. And even in foreign policy, if one looks at it, there is no big picture. There, you know, fine, so maybe there's an attempted coup in Montenegro. Well, that's fine. That's obviously seemingly significant, especially if you're in Montenegro. But it does not represent a big idea. Even Crimea. Look, Crimea was opportunistic. Crimea happened basically because the Ukrainian state fell apart and they just thought, oh, actually, why not? And, you know, it was unique in its place in the Russian
run with that, with the whole Novorossiya stuff and Donbass and everything.
Well, this is it. I mean, exactly, because I think they thought, oh, you know, we're on a roll now.
I mean, I think the Balkans could have some kind of resonance in the Russian imagination. The Balkans loom very large. War in the
Look,
Balkans.
Let's be perfectly honest, the Donbass does not. I mean, you know, the very fact that they still keep it. I mean, we know vastly more about what's going on in the Donbass than your average Russian news consumer. Because precisely, they don't want to admit that what they're doing. Now, if you felt this was something that was going to be some grand narrative, which is going to sort of basically infuse the Russian people, you would be having, you know, it leading every single news bulletin rather than pretending Russian soldiers. No. So I think this is it. I mean, I think what we see is actually this extraordinary issue. And so take this back to this business of it's Navalny versus the Putin system. What's really fascinating is in some ways Putin is becoming irrelevant. I mean, on the one hand, look.
Oh, be careful. The last time we said that was 2012.
Well, but I mean, look, he is obviously, he has phenomenal power. He can basically have anyone arrested or worse. He can decide anything or whatever. But what's striking is he hasn't. I mean, actually, there's been a distinct lack of decision making.
Don't give him ideas, Mark.
I'm always right. And do I get my Moscow gold? I never do. No, I mean, I think things look. Yes, of course. he clearly could do very many things. But one thing we do know about Putin is that he doesn't like acting if he doesn't think he knows the outcome. He can get it wrong, as with the Donbass. But nonetheless, you know, he thought he had it all sewn up. And I think this speaks to something. And okay, it's always dangerous to try and guess what's going on in Putin's mind. But this speaks to, I think, to me, a sense of a degree of paralysis at the very center. And when the center is paralyzed, it's not that other people at the moment are coming up with big ideas. They're scrabbling around for relatively small issues of factional or personal interest. We're seeing a state that is currently involved in a degree of cannibalism.
What do you make of Navalny's story, and how compelling is this story? Because Navalny is telling a story.
Well, I mean, it's a lovely story. And in some ways, I would actually make it a bit more negative. And I think that's actually a strength. It's on one level, it's yes, we can. And that's all very nice. And I can see how an American would be emphasizing that. Me, you know, I'm a European, and therefore just a bit more crabbed and small-souled. Well, no, I mean, I will continue to be a European. I just might be a slightly different European. But the point is that actually a big part of Navalny's message is basically we are all being screwed. And we know who is screwing us. And in a way, although it's democratic and it's positive and it's about, you know, rule of law and so forth, the subtext is, you know, those people who screwed us, they're not going to have so much fun when we're in charge. And I'm not talking about, you know, people being shot in the streets or whatever. But but we're talking about, you know, investigations and everything else. Because the point is, actually, every Russian does know that they're being screwed. And I think this is one of his great powers, is actually that, you know, he has found a narrative which sort of is able to combine the positive, life could be better.
We can do better
The negative, yes, we're all actually being messed around by the same people. And we know who that are. And it doesn't matter if you're rich, poor, if you're from Moscow or Magadan, you actually are all being exploited by the same people.
Natalia, any last thoughts before we shift gears?
Well, just to say that I completely agree with Mark. And I think that the degree of negativity would actually appeal more to the Russian general public, because people here tend to be more negative than Americans. That's just a fact of life. And I think they already hate their local officials. Let's put it this way. They already despise their local officials. So it's not as if Navalny has to up the negativity so much at all. It's already there. It's already there for him to work with.
But he's effectively combining a positive message and a negative message here. Then it's almost so. It's not the purely positive American centric. Yes, we can. That as I framed it, but it's also another message that we've often seen pop up in politics across the West right now. It's this anti-populist, anti-establishment rage that we're seeing sweeping the West. And I, as I've been saying for a long time, Russia ain't immune to this. And when it hits, and when it hits Russia, it's not going to be pretty.
Except, I mean, but key difference here, though, is of course in the West, a lot of the rage is actually about, frankly, sort of fear of change, misunderstanding, a mistargeting.
And racism, don't forget the
well, this is it. Yeah, exactly. You know, a mistargeting of who you think is to blame, and that's where obviously the racism tends to sort of come in. Whereas in Russia, actually, these are people who have a very, very real grievance, a very reason to be angry.
Right. Well, this will be interesting to watch going forward, and we'll shift gears now. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the teenagers who are taking on the Kremlin. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment Zone, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, an editor at Open Democracy Russia. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Ребята, привет! Это Навальный.
Приходите, действительно, на Тверскую.
4 часа.
They don't remember the Soviet Union and thus appear to have little nostalgia for it. They don't remember the wild and chaotic 1990s, so they don't fear their return. They've known no other leader but Vladimir Putin, and they appear to be tired of him. And in Alexei Navalny, they seem to think they found a leader they can believe in. Natalia, much has been made of the youth of those who took to the streets in nationwide protests, both on March 26th and on June 12th. How real is this generation gap we seem to be seeing? And has the Kremlin truly lost the youth? What does this mean?
Well, I think it's very real. And in fact, it makes me very old to talk about it. Because I, of course, was born in the Soviet Union before I immigrated to the States.
I was born under the Kennedy administration. So if you're old, I'm ancient.
let's just admit it. We're all getting kind of old here. I mean, I'm really feeling my age with these protests, of course. But I do think that there is a generation gap. These people, a lot of them did grow up just basically knowing one leader. And I don't think they think it's normal. Of course, the majority of the youth in Russia is still fairly apolitical, I think. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, as we've been talking for a while now, the Kremlin's kind of run out of stories to tell people. It has run out of narratives. And I think that is especially being felt by this generation that grew up mm-hmm. under Putin. I mean, they really don't have a narrative for them. And they already naturally are predisposed to go against authority because they're young. But also there's just the fact that, look, there is a real sense right now in Russia that things are not going to get much better. I mean, I'm here like on and off. I come, I visit, I leave. And I've just noticed the fact that in the grocery stores, like some of the stuff I used to buy, like it is now 3 or 4 times more expensive. Imagine being, you know, a student right now, a mm-hmm. student, in, not necessarily in Moscow, but a student in Ufa and looking, you know, at prices, like just basic food prices and thinking to yourself, okay, something's going on here. You know what I mean? I don't think that when you're this young, you don't have a family to take care of. So you're not necessarily as plugged into the economics, but you're feeling, you're getting the sense mm-hmm. that something's off. That's A. B, Russia, of course, has one of the highest teen suicide rates in Europe, I believe. I was just looking this up today, and it's like in the top 3 or something like that. And that's a problem. You know what I mean? They actually have been working on ways to get this rate down, and they have been successful. You know, I'm not going to completely bash the government here and say they're not doing their jobs, because it has been... Suicide has been on the agenda, teen suicide specifically, but, you know, I don't know if that progress is really being made at the kind of pace that it should be. Putin was at his telethon now talking about fertile young mothers and how women in their 20s need support in order to have kids. and women in their 30s do, and so on. And he's discussing this demographics issue, which I think young people, especially young people who come out in support of Navalny, but I think young people in general, they don't care about that. They don't want this traditionalism, this paternalism that is being foisted upon them by the state. It doesn't make them feel cared for, like, for example, with the older generation. You know, when I was I had my baby in Moscow. I'm a crazy person. Actually, it turned out to not be like a crazy thing. Actually, I saved a ton of money. But when I had my baby in Moscow, everybody was telling me, look, like, isn't this great? You have a good state healthcare system. You were treated so well. I mean, I gave birth on the state's dime completely for free. And I'm like, yeah, sure. To someone like me, that's obviously going to matter. When you're 18 years old, you do not care about that. So a lot of these narratives that the Kremlin has in place to, you know, inspire the population, as it were, those same narratives are not working on people who are 15, 16. They don't care about this stuff. You know, what they care about is, you know, when Pornhub is turned off in the country, when you can't access your porn.
I knew you were going to bring Pornhub into this discussion.
I'm so going to bring Pornhub into this, you know, because I write about it, and I think Pornhub is a great, like, I think Pornhub does a great job with their statistics. I think it's wonderful that they have statistics on Russia and other countries that they compile that we can look at and look at all the trends. And I'm just saying that, like, you know, if I'm like, you know, a 16-year-old boy, am I going to care about these maternity programs or whatever that Putin's touting on TV? I'm not going to care about that. I'm going to care about the fact that they've blocked access to my porn, which is now back, by the way. You know, Pornhub is back in Russia. I've checked on it.
Well, there's a larger point to this. I mean, this social conservative narrative that Putin's been pushing is not flying with the youth. It's working for him with the older generation, but he's losing the youth here.
He's totally using it. And the thing is, it's not even really working that much with the older generation either. Because, of course, on the surface, everybody in Russia loves to pretend they're conservative and they're Christian or they're Muslim or whatever, and they're such good Christians. But honestly, like, 11% of Russians go to church regularly. 11%. You know, compare that to the United States, where the number is like way, way higher. And then, you know, and then tell me which one is the really conservative country. You know, like, hint, it's not Russia. Russia's not genuinely a conservative country. It people like to pretend that they're conservative. So, and I think, yeah, with young people in general, I mean, honestly, that whole narrative, I think, is out the window. They don't care. It doesn't appeal to them. And, you know, in the absence of these narratives, who's going to appeal to them? Well, a figure like Navalny might, or, you know, it could be actually a much worse figure. You know, God knows who they're worshiping in Magnitogorsk right now. Like, I would be really curious to see that.
Well, in this piece that I mentioned earlier by Oleg Kashin in Republic.ru, he makes the point that Navalny is counting on the idealism of this young generation overcoming the cynicism of pretty much everybody else. Is that a winning strategy, Mark?
No, absolutely not, because in that case, you're actually talking about precisely creating a generational clash. I think it's worth mentioning, if one looks at Levada polling data, they actually show that the young is also really quite supportive of Putin.
Well, this is how I was going to get to that.
I mean, I think in some ways it's not so much the young are against Putin or any kind of similar thing. It's actually that those members of the young sort of cohort who are angry with the regime are active. Precisely, they're willing to do something. Firstly, because, I mean, they have less to lose. Then, you know, I mean, part of the stupidity we all have when we're 16 is basically we think that, you know, nothing can possibly go wrong and so forth. Mm. Whereas actually, you know, once you're 36, you know the many, many things that can go wrong. And so they have less to lose, but they also have less to hope for. You know, because it's precisely that it's in their sort of more recent years that they have actually seen the quality of life slip, not increase. They have actually seen the opportunities diminish, not get better. They have seen the mismatch, as Natalia was saying, between incomes and prices get worse and worse and worse, so much so that, you know, the average Russian household spends more than half of its take-home on food these days.
Which is insane. It's insane.
It is ridiculous. So I think for all these reasons, you know, if you are already thinking, actually, this is not the way things should be, I think you're more likely to now, therefore, to go out there and act. So, I mean, I think the key thing is this. It's not just simply about, well, which cohort is pro-Navalny and which is anti. It's precisely who's willing to do something. And I think the thing is, what's striking is actually, it's almost like different cohorts have different ways in which they are responding. You have the sort of, I mean, if one looks at, for example, what, you know, okay, it's very, very partial and frankly, half the time anecdotal, but evidence about people involved in industrial action, they tend to be late 20s to 40. Mm-hmm. So in other words, they probably have a young family or, you know, say a kid. They're very, very conscious, therefore, of the impact of, you know, shrinking earnings in real terms on not just them, but their kid. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the sort of thing that really... So in a way, you have the late teens and the early adolescents who are out there protesting for Navalny. Then you have a sort of an older cohort, slightly older cohort, who are actually out there protesting for where's my damn salary. And then, of course, you know, if one looks at the other end, I mean, you know, the pensioners and the veterans, well, they're still Communist Party and to a lesser extent Zhirinovsky sort of cohort, which, again, on one level doesn't matter so long as these are parties that are still just simply willing to be the fake opposition.
Right.
But if, for example, the communists do end up shifting, which is one of my little hobby horses, then actually we could see that cohort shifting as well. I mean, I think this is the interesting thing, is there is so much in different forms of protest potential within Russia. But the point is, at present, it operates in different ways, at different times, and through different idioms.
Well, I can't help recall, on Monday, as I was watching social media as the protests were unfolding, and the photos, maybe it says more about my feed than anything, but I think it looked to me for a while like the police were not arresting anybody except young teenage girls. I don't know if either of you noticed this on social media, but there were photo after photo after photo after photo of handcuffed young teenage girls being taken away. Later, they got mixed in with a lot of, you know, whatever, handcuffed 20-something guys as well. But this, you're right, Mark, this isn't the only young cohort. And I read an article recently, if I'm not mistaken, it was in Vietnamese, about how the Kremlin is looking at targeting so-called conformist youth in the upcoming election.
Which they've been, I mean, they've tried that in so many ways.
This is Nazism, basically.
Exactly, and since. I mean, the trouble is this notion of conformity. The thing that always strikes me is, you know, you turn on a TV in Russia, and, you know, on the one hand, you can flip it on a Sunday morning, and on Zvezda, you can have Sluzhu Rossi, all, you know, tanks and sort of, you know, aircraft and how wonderful the Russian military is. And then you flip channels, and you're basically watching dubbed Friends.
Right.
I mean, the interesting thing is precisely that actually, you know, you have this cohort that, you know, and we tend to think about state control because of the news, but in terms of the cultural messages that they've been given, actually it's become a buffet. And I don't think it's many people who just, well, except for me, who just watch Sluzhu Rossi.
Natalia, anything to add here?
Well, I think I want to go back to Mark's point about the communists and Zhirinovsky's party, LDPR. As I've been arguing over and over again, riding on my own hobby horse, I keep saying that the problem for Putin is that support for him is extremely passive. And in any kind of serious crisis, this pet opposition that he has, these communists / Zhirinovsky, they're going to turn from his pets to, you know, rabid dogs in a hurry. Like, and I'm not talking about a situation where they're going to be deployed against the populace. You know, Putin has the National Guard for that now. But what I'm talking about is that if they should feel that the center is getting weak, or if Putin picks the wrong kind of successor, all of these people are really kind of fake in their praise and loyalty for Dear Leader. It's so obvious. It's always been that way. And you're seeing now the Communist Party kind of trying to rebrand itself and trying to go after young people. It's doing that for a reason, I think, because as Mark has written elsewhere, and I forget which article it was, but, you know, like when we're talking about now that people are basically actually beginning to sort of whisper about a future without Putin, because he's not going to be in charge of this country forever. You physically can't. This is the communists trying to recruit young people. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it out of loyalty to the Kremlin. I don't think. I think they're doing it out of loyalty to their own goals and to themselves, and so they can be better positioned in the future when there is a possibly power vacuum. So I think that I don't know how it's going to play out. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm always the pessimist. I am always predicting the end of the world, and I always hope to be wrong about it. But I do want to say that it's almost like when people begin to plan for instability and for a future power vacuum, it becomes a self-fulfilling mm-hmm. prophecy in a way. And I would be very interested to see how that plays out.
Well, this is quite interesting, because I've been thinking a lot lately about how people are starting to think about life after Putin. And you're even seeing articles in the pro-Kremlin media talking about life after Putin. There was a piece in Moskovsky Komsomolets a couple of weeks back. I don't know if either of you saw this. It got a lot of attention because there was some speculation in the piece that Putin might be ill. But the whole premise of the piece was Putin hasn't announced he's running for president yet. And as a result of this, there's rumors about this is how they kind of got into the story. But the story was about life after Putin. Like, who could replace Putin? What could possibly happen after Putin? This was an MK. You don't usually see things like that in MK. And the mere appearance of this made me think about it. Now, all of this focus on the youth. What are the youth? Well, they're the future, right? So everybody in everybody kind of focusing on the youth, whether it's Navalny, the communists, or the Kremlin fantasizing about, again, focusing on conformist youth. It's everybody seems to be thinking about life after Putin, no?
Yeah, well, and I think this is the future argument is key here, because Russia has this terrible habit of eating its young. And I think maybe the Kremlin's going to decide that it needs a large scale war and a huge conscription drive to basically kind of just, you want a future without Putin. We just won't have a future. Nobody will have a future. Mm-hmm. But that's just me, the paranoiac and, the doomsday prophet. I'm just putting that out there as a possible theory about what might happen. I hope I'm wrong. Mark, please tell me.
Mark, tell us she's wrong.
You're wrong. Absolutely. No, I mean, conscription actually is a great way of not only annoying your youth, but also actually training them in how to fight. Really, really, if you're worried about youth, you basically want them. You want to be handing out free PlayStations and candy bars.
Don't forget the porn.
Well, this is it. Yes, of course. But they of course only watch it for the statistics. But I mean, going on to this business about sort of kids of the future, which of course they are. But also, actually, if one looks at the usual trajectories, your political views that you have when you're 16, you do not necessarily also share when you're 40. But I would make one other point here, and this is, demonstrates my detailed knowledge of biology. Kids have parents. And I think one of the interesting things...
I think you've opened up a Pandora's box here.
Yeah, exactly. I know we're taking it beyond sort of the usual realm. No, I mean, kids have parents. And one of the interesting things that we've seen is that not only is there a lack of any evidence, as near as I can tell, of there precisely being this kind of fissure. It's not actually as if, and I'm sure we'd hear a lot of it, if we had stories about people saying, I was so embarrassed about what my kids have done and so forth. We've seen teachers being sort of forced into that kind of role in loco parentis, but not actually parents. And if the state cracks down more enthusiastically in future protests, which actually have youngsters, I do wonder quite what that will do in terms of pushing the older generation. Because I know that in Bolotnaya, 2011, 2012, when, again, you had a lot of not so much 16-year-olds, but sort of, 20-year-olds, shall we say. And just from talking to people there, I mean, it was clear that a lot of these were kids of fairly well-to-do, affluent, politically well-connected Muscovite families. Mm-hmm. And talking to people who had kids at Bolotnaya, they were not saying how terrible. They were saying, basically, the state better not do too much that's too harsh to them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think this is one of the interesting things that actually how the state responds to the 16-year-olds might well actually have a very, much more dramatic impact on the 26, 46-year-olds.
There's an analogy, and it's actually right here in Prague. And one of the things I noticed during these protests, I couldn't help but notice, was the people jiggling their keys in the air. Now, that is reminiscent of the Velvet Revolution. This was the action during the Velvet Revolution when people were chanting Havel Naharad, Havel to the castle. They were jiggling their keys in the air. And I was actually impressed and surprised that the Russian protesters. But with as far as the children, the way that revolution started was you essentially had a student demonstration, a sanctioned student demonstration on a sanctioned communist holiday that got politicized. Remember, this is 1989, after all. It got politicized. The Czechoslovak police came in and very brutally suppressed it. And this enraged the parents, because this is what the Czechs call the Husak generation. This was the generation after the 68 Soviet invasion. People basically had a lot of kids because there was nothing else to do, right? And it's a huge generation, right? And those parents got infuriated. They said, you could take our freedom, but don't you touch our children. And that was the beginning of the end. Now, you have to wonder, does that replicate itself in Russia? I don't know. It's a different country, different time.
Different country, different situation. Times, but on the other hand, there is a certain sort of biological imperative.
Yeah. Oh yeah, nothing. I mean, I can tell you as a mother, when I became a mother, I certainly became way more political right away. Mm-hmm. Obviously, just because I'm a U.S. citizen. Obviously, my general passions and anger are currently directed at what's happening with Trump. But I can definitely relate to the argument that once you have children, you do want them to have a future of some kind, preferably not a horrible dystopian one. And that it does make people very angry. And I do think that I have noticed a lot of people, let's say just in my Facebook feed, I have a lot of apolitical Russians in my Facebook feed for various reasons, because I know a lot of actors and, actors tend to actors are actors, they just want to act and so on. And but I did notice that when, as you were saying, Brian, those pictures of the police hauling around these fragile young girls are hitting your feed. A lot of the people who are apolitical get very upset about that, mm-hmm. because as we've been talking about, it's a question of optics, and it just looks very, very brutal and scary to them. And also there's just the fact that, what are these guys like? Are they cowards? Why are they grabbing these women? Are they like, is this like a bizarre way of trying to like flirt with them or so on? Like, what is going on here? Like, this is really gross. So I do think that there is this issue of optics and biology that does greatly influence this. But of course, once again, one of the big problems with Russia is the extent to which it has in the past really eaten its young and denied the young a future. And I get this very visceral feeling here that Putin's generation, and it's not just Putin himself, it's a lot of different people in that group. Like, you could take director Stanislav Govoruchin, who he had a great career in like the 80s, for example, very successful, really didn't find himself after the Soviet Union fell, really didn't produce anything on that same level. So basically, he has now dedicated his life to shutting down young filmmakers, just making sure that they're censored and they can't get their movies shown, just really kind of pushing this culture of censorship just so this young generation of filmmakers just doesn't have an impact in society at all, just completely marginalized. And I do think that there is, for whatever reason, there's that tradition in Russia that has existed for generations now. And I think that should be a very big concern to, to every parent and to every observer of the country. Like, we should always factor that in.
Now, one thing I'd actually like to know, how young were these kids? Because I couldn't tell just by looking at the photos. Are these, when we say teenagers, that's anywhere from 13 to 19. I'm getting the sense here, you're talking people, 17 to early 20s? What are we talking about here?
14, 15, 16, that young, 17. That young. Yeah. There's definitely 14-year-olds detained in March. I don't know how many 14-year-olds were detained now, but there's already all this talk about punishing the parents, of course. Like, if you have a 14-year-old kid, he winds up in an unsanctioned protest, punish the parents, which is, maybe that's a good strategy in the short term. I don't see it winning hearts and minds in the long term, but who knows?
Mark, any last thoughts before we call it a week?
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up on that, I mean, it's interesting that they actually specifically announced that the minors who had been arrested, ORS, had actually been released. Mm-hmm. So clearly, again, I mean, that in itself was an admission that there were many people who were below the age of criminal responsibility. So, yeah, absolutely. But, yeah, I mean, go back to this issue of sort of the kind of devouring the youth. And particularly in Putin's generation. And that's absolutely true. But of course, one of the interesting things is we've also seen this lead to basically the lack of any kind of meaningful young generation of Putinistas. Yeah, I mean, every now and then they sort of create these new, we're going to have this new movement and you know, whatever, and we're going to have a sort of, you know, pop videos with young girls tearing off their T-shirts for Putin or whatever. But actually,
just,
you know,
stupid.
You know, once they have that little sort of, you know, flurry, it never goes anywhere. And in part, it's precisely because the Putin generation of political leaders are very, very jealous of power. And the last thing they want is these hungry newcomers coming up. Even if you look at the kids of members of the elite, on the whole, they're moved into business, not politics. So again, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that, yes, in many ways, it is a deeply unpleasant sort of trope that we've seen. But in some ways, it also actually, I think, weakens the base of the state itself.
I mean, you've seen different efforts. You've seen things like, now I just saw how the National Guard is creating cadet schools around Russia to bring kids into that. You saw the whole creation of SIT network. You know, this was the son of Nashi, basically. You, of course, had Nashi. You had the reports a few years back about how Putin was kind of sending the security services into the provinces to recruit young people to bring to Moscow to give them a good job in the middle bureaucracy. And this was seen as kind of creating a new generation of replenishing the cadre, if you will. But you don't think any of that has...
No, I mean, it's one thing with kind of cadets who have a very kind of clear military-style progression, whether they're, you know, Suvorov School Army cadets or the National Guard or police, you know, all these things where you actually have a very clear trajectory. But then, frankly, that's a professional trajectory rather than anything else. If we're looking at actually kind of political attempts to recruit politically, yeah, it's fine. So you recruit them and you say it's going to be great and whatever. But then people very quickly hit this ceiling, I think.
Can I bring it back to sex for a moment? I feel like we haven't had enough sex on this podcast.
It's a family podcast. Be careful here, Natalia.
Yeah, but I'm gonna couch it in very kind of civilized terms. But I will just say that
PG-13.
Well, you know, Mark did bring up the fact that you have these young women tearing their clothes off for Putin or whatever. You have these calendars. Then you had that one guy who basically touched a bunch of breasts and then he shook Putin's hand and that was supposed to be cool. The thing is that Putin, you know, as a man, has lost that momentum. He is older now. He's older now, and you know, if he has sex appeal, it's for older people. For like this whole drama of young women, like it's not happening anymore.
You're saying Putin's lost his mojo.
He's kind of with the young. He's lost his mojo. It's a natural thing that happens. You know, he is an older man now.
54 years old.
There's nothing wrong. He shouldn't be appealing to 16-year-old girls. Like, if he's an older man who's trying to appeal to 16-year-old girls in that way, then that's beginning to look kind of creepy. And you know, there talk of concubines arises. You know, when you said like that whole that momentum has been lost. I think with the sex appeal for the young, it just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't look good. It's not a good look for him. I think he knows this. I mean, he's not dumb, but it's just clearly one of those things where you have to look at the sex factor and say, okay, well, that's just done as a concept. It's over. It's been played out.
And just to bring this all back full circle, is Navalny replacing Putin as the man with the mojo?
I'm more worried that Brian was looking at me when he asked that question, but that's another matter.
I was speaking more broadly, folks.
I don't know. Navalny doesn't try to position himself as this virile, you know, strong man.
He tries to position himself as a tough guy. But yeah, he also is very conscious. He's conscious of his optics. The photos of him with his family are very compelling in a way that, I mean, this is broader than sex appeal.
But here's the interesting thing. Cheap. Pictures of him with his family.
Nerds are cooler now in some ways than strong men, right? Mm. So it's that.
But I'm saying, this interesting thing, Navalny, exactly, he brings his family in. Navalny is a relatively younger man who has to show that he has the sort of the stability and the solidity of being a family man. Whereas precisely the slightly sort of tawdry, sub-Berlusconi-esque Putin...
Divorced
and, you know, completely taboo subject, lots and lots of salacious gossip and so forth. But precisely, you know, he does not bring family into it, except those few times when he wants to sort of, you know, make political capital just by mentioning grandkids and such like. So again, I mean, I think this is the sort of the funny thing. We have the older Putin who has to try and find ways of connecting with the younger generation without seeming too creepy, But on the other hand, it's easier for Navalny to, on one hand, be hip older brother who knows, what the kids are talking about these days. But at the same time, wife, kid, it's sort of the full demonstration that he is actually, as a family man, he's someone whom you can trust as a sort of an older figure as well.
Well, on that note, we shall wrap it up before we get into too dangerous territory on this this lively Friday afternoon. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, an editor at Open Democracy Russia. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
It's been a particular pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.